The Battle for Liberty, Episode 31.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. As always, I'm going to remind you of a few things before we get started. Number one, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. That helps me out because it helps my download numbers. If you could do me one better, tell a friend about the show. I want to spread the word about the Battle for Liberty as far as possible, and the thing that grows the show the most is word of mouth. So refer that friend, and you'll really be doing me a big favor. Check us out on Facebook at the Battle for Liberty Facebook page. That's facebook.com/battleforliberty. We're on the web at battleforliberty.com. Suppose I should have mentioned that one first. Whatever. Follow me on Twitter at mybattleliberty. Follow me on Gab at Battle for Liberty. And if you want to email me, that email address is mike@battleforliberty.com. We will have a show notes page for this show and every show that we do. It's always battleforliberty.com/ and then the episode number. So this one will be battleforliberty.com/31. And that's that one convenient location where you can get all of the content that I'm going to talk about on this episode. All right, well, welcome back. It's been a lightning fast week for me. I don't know about you. Work got really busy for me this past week, and all of my free time has basically vanished. So before I get started into today's content, I wanted to let you know that I have some great guests coming up in the next few weeks. I really hope you've enjoyed the past couple of weeks where I've had guests on the show. It's been a lot of fun to do it that way, and I've got more great guests lined up for the next couple of episodes. And I don't want to announce who the guests are just yet, but I do have a list of people who have agreed to be on the show, and now it's just a matter of getting the schedules aligned and getting the interviews recorded and everything set up just properly. But rest assured, I am going to stay strong on the New Year's resolution to bring more guests onto the show. Now, if my download numbers are a good clue, then it's really obvious to me that the guests are very interesting to you. And I think you get a little bit more out of the time that we spend together when there's multiple opinions, multiple people, a nice back and forth discussion going on. I think that's more enjoyable, and certainly the download numbers are showing that to be the case. But this week, I just couldn't get it together to have a guest this week. So you're stuck with me once again for another solo episode. But I will do my best not to bore you to tears. Are you ready? All right, let's go. On last week's episode, my guest Arthur Clarue and I clashed over the discussion between the merits of minarchy versus anarchy. And that was a great discussion, and I had an absolute blast talking with him. He's a gentleman, and even though I disagree with him, it was a productive conversation, I think, for both of us. If you haven't listened to that episode, do yourself a favor, and right as soon as you're done listening to this episode, go listen to that one. That one can be found at battleforliberty.com/30. Now, during that conversation, one of the themes that developed, or at least one of the claims that was made, was that minarchists tend to think of themselves as more realistic than anarchists, who tend to be more idealistic. Now, it's possible that that's a correct analysis, but I'm not so sure that's actually the case. See, I know a lot of anarchists might have gotten upset over what happened last week when I kind of ceded the territory and just said, okay, well, maybe it's true that anarchists are more idealistic. And it's right if those anarchists got upset. See, they have a good argument in claiming that it's actually the opposite that's true. See, there's a lot of evidence that leads me to believe that those same people who call us anarchists too idealistic are themselves the ones who are being idealistic. All right, how so? Well, there's no proof that any government in the history of the world has ever been able to stay small or minimal as the minarchists would want. See, the minarchists have their sights set on a small, unobtrusive government that's limited to a short list of agreed upon but necessary powers. See, and in that system that they envision, the government bureaucrats believe in those limits and they adhere to them steadfastly. And in that system, the politicians respect the limits on their power and only infrequently try to exert control over peaceful people. Additionally, in that system, the foundational governing documents are known and understood by enough voters that there's little risk of them selecting nefarious people who would administer that minuscule government in a malevolent way. And even though that supposed system that the minarchists advocate, even though it's been tried and shown to fail, they still cling to the notion that somehow it'll just work one day if only they can tweak the parameters just slightly. So, as I've said, I think there's a decent argument to be made that the minarchists are being too idealistic. Whereas anarchists can just as easily be said to be the realistic side. I mean, after all, what do anarchists actually want? Well, they want a society in which no singular entity has a monopoly on the use of force. They want people to engage in voluntary transactions with each other rather than resorting to forcible rule by a numerical majority. And do anarchists claim that such a system would be a utopia free from all violence and malfeasance? No, nothing of the sort. Anarchists simply wish to abolish a power structure that claims that it requires a monopoly in order to function. I mean, isn't it just an agreed-upon position that monopoly winds up being a bad thing for every consumer in every example? Why would it be any different when the government holds that monopoly? It's still a bad thing. So now you tell me, after this quick rundown, who's being idealistic and who's being realistic? Isn't it possible that perhaps the analysis should go the opposite way? I certainly think so. So suffice to say, all of this is meant just to make the point that I think the argument over who's being idealistic versus realistic, I think that argument is far from over. But I do want to have an exercise in philosophy today. I feel like stretching my mind a little bit. So I'm going to take it on the chin and I'm going to say, you know what, I'll just accept. For the sake of argument, I'll concede that anarchists are idealistic in their politics. Again, I'm not saying this is actually the case, but for the argument, let's just go with it. So, if it's indeed true that anarchists are idealistic or even ideological, well, I'm here to tell you there's a very good reason for that. So that's what the rest of the show is going to be about. We're going to be talking about libertarianism and specifically idealism in libertarianism. See, it's always said that being too dogmatic or being too idealistic is a bad thing. But I ask why? See, from my perspective, it's not that that I want to be a stick in the mud. It's not that I fail to see that there are some potential problems with strict ideology in general. I do. I understand why people think that. But there's something bigger at play here, and that's what I want to get into. So what's really at play here, and what has led many of us in the anarchism camp to support such strict ideology based upon primary moral principles? What's led us to do that is consistency. Now, let me see if I can elaborate on that. See, libertarians support policies that are, some policies that are presently seen as leftist, things like being anti-war and anti-death penalty and anti-conscription and anti-victimless crimes. Those are all traditionally, at least today, seen as leftist causes. But But then libertarians also support policies that are presently thought of as extreme right wing. Things like free market economies and the inviolability of property rights and free exchange and freedom of association. Those are all seen as right wing policies and conclusions. But see, most political pundits today would say that this dichotomy between supposedly opposite positions, they would think it's confusing, and they'd even, some would go so far as to say, oh, that's just the middle ground, right? Some of this side and some of that side, that must be the middle ground. But the truth is that it's nothing more than consistency. Because all of those policy preferences are traced back to the primary principles that I talk about almost every week, namely property rights and non-aggression. But as we found out last week in the conversation that I had with Arthur Clarue, some libertarians adhere to minarchism, or what I'm going to call utilitarianism, because I think they're the same thing. See, I've talked about utilitarianism before on the podcast, but for new listeners, let's briefly review. So who are the utilitarians? Well, according to Rothbard, the utilitarians declare, from their study of the consequences of liberty, as opposed to alternative systems, that liberty will lead more surely to widely approved goals, things like harmony, peace, prosperity, etc. So what he's saying is that utilitarians aren't quite as concerned with the inviolability of the primary principles. They don't have necessarily strict moral foundations, which they always adhere to. No, rather, utilitarians favor policies that are in line with those principles, but only when their consequences are predicted to result in popularly ordained goals. See, now this is a major division between the two camps that Rothbard is describing. He's describing utilitarians versus natural rights libertarians. Now, Rothbard uses those terms, different terms that I'm using, but the differences are the same. I'm calling the two camps minarchists and anarchists, but aren't they really the same as utilitarians and natural rights libertarians? Rothbard continues. Now, no one disputes that relative consequences should be studied in assessing the merits or demerits of respective creeds. But there are many problems in confining ourselves to a utilitarian ethic. For one thing, utilitarianism assumes that we can weigh alternatives and decide upon policies on the basis of their good or bad consequences. But if it's legitimate to apply value judgments to the consequences of X, why is it not equally legitimate to apply such judgments to X itself? May there not be something about an act itself which, in its very nature, can be considered good or evil? You see, it's precisely this line of reasoning that leads many anarchists, myself included, to the free admission of being doctrinaire. Because we believe that the principles themselves are inviolable, regardless of any value judgments that are ultimately placed on their applications, right? As Rothbard said, I mean, can't it be true that there's something about an act itself which by its very nature is good or bad? That's what I'm getting at here. That's what I'm talking about with the primary principles. Funny enough, it turns out to be a happy coincidence that adherence to those primary principles yields consistently prosperous and peaceful outcomes. Gee, isn't that funny? But see, this can be difficult to understand. I know this is a lot of philosophical mumbo jumbo, a lot of jargon. I've gotten very deep and very philosophical. And especially if you're a new listener and you're new to libertarianism, it might be hard to see how this plays out in the real world. So I'd like to provide you with what I think is a perfect example from one of the most intelligent utilitarians I've ever read or heard. And that would be the distinguished Milton Friedman. The example I'm going to use comes in the form of a 1996 article by Lawrence Vance regarding the Earned Income Tax Credit. The article is called Friedman's Mistake, and I'm going to read this to you in its entirety. And I don't usually do that. I usually don't like to read articles from start to finish on the show. I mean, I could just send you the link and you could read it. But in this particular case, it turns out that the entire article is necessary for a proper understanding. And as an added bonus, Lawrence Vance is just such a great writer. Why on earth would I try to cut it down? Well, I wouldn't. So let's go ahead and read the article, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. Friedman's Mistake, November 1st, 1996, by Lawrence Vance. This is found in The Free Market, which is the monthly publication of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. In the famed 1995 budget battles between the White House and the Congress, Bill Clinton told a whopper that put him on the rhetorical offensive. He said that Congress's proposed cuts in a particular program amounted to, quote, raising taxes on the poor, end quote. It was classic Clinton. He could oppose a bill that curbed spending while not having to defend programs that should be cut, even as he posed as anti-tax. Spooked by this rhetorical razzmatazz, Congress backed off. But was Congress really trying to raise taxes on the poor? At issue is the misnamed Earned Income Tax Credit, a widely misunderstood and hugely expensive program. Congress was attempting to trim it around the edges. How could Clinton get away with calling spending cuts tax increases? Part of the confusion arises from the name and the ideological origins of the program. Milton Friedman's 1962 book, Capitalism and Freedom, made a surprising concession to the socialists. He said, we need, quote, a floor below which no man's net income could fall, end quote, a program also called a guaranteed national income. It should be provided through a, quote, negative income tax, said Freeman, an odd phrase for an outright cash subsidy administered through the tax system. We might as well call a tax a negative wage. In his program, if a person's income exceeds exemptions and deductions, he pays a tax. If it falls under, he pays a negative tax, that is, he gets a check. The idea claimed to use the tax code to encourage people to get off conventional welfare and live on earned income, while creating no new bureaucracies. And what will keep the program under control? The self-restraint and goodwill of the electorate. But Friedman failed to consider how this system would work in the real world. People undertake adaptive strategies to get on and stay on the dole whenever it's available. That the program is cheap to administer makes it all the more dangerous. Refuting Friedman, Henry Hazlitt showed that the only way to get people off welfare is to stop the payments. Nonetheless, Friedman's idea eventually made it into law. The year was 1975, and Gerald Ford and the Democratic Congress cooperated in imposing the Tax Reduction Act of 1975. A list of similarly named bills in the post-war period would suggest that taxes have been declining for decades. Now, buried in the bill was an end-of-the-year tax credit for low-income taxpayers. It claimed to increase the incentive to work instead of being on welfare. Again, this trick is as old as the welfare state itself. It was more than a tax deduction. It was refundable up to $400. It was a direct subsidy available whether or not you had paid any taxes at all. As Friedman said, the subsidy involves low administrative costs because it is facilitated by the tax return itself. If you are eligible, you simply say so, and it is made part of your refund check. It looks like a deduction, sounds like a deduction, but it's actually welfare. There was a notable difference between this particular tax credit and other forms of welfare. There was no asset test or net worth ceiling to qualify. Again, just as Friedman had suggested earlier. Having two cars in the driveway, a yacht in the marina, and a private plane at the airport does not disqualify anyone from receiving it. Low income and poor, it turns out, are not necessarily the same thing. Like many new programs, it was supposed to be temporary, but year by year, Congress extended it on the urging of Ford, Carter, Reagan, and then Bush. And like every other government program, the benefits went up and up and up. In 1977, the maximum a family could receive went to $500, and a new partial tax credit was given on incomes up to $10,000. It increased again in 1984 for a new maximum of $550. By 1990, it had reached $953. Not only that, the program became more expansive. It began to give more money if the recipient had two children instead of one. Also new was an additional credit up to $357 if a child was under 1 year old. It was under Clinton that the program went berserk. In 1993, the maximum refund was up to $1,511, and by 2 years later, had actually doubled to a whopping $3,110. At the end of 1996, it will reach its highest ever at $3,564. Also introduced in 1994 was the same tax credit for a single person with no dependents. What began as a $1.2 billion program in 1974, now, my addition in 1996, now costs almost $25 billion a year. So much for getting people off welfare. It has become an instrument for recruiting new dependents and massively redistributing income. One does not have to be working to get it. Neither does one have to be poor. A worker can get payments included in his paycheck. As the fastest growing single item in the welfare state, it is becoming the guaranteed national income that socialists have long dreamed about imposing. With a fraud rate estimated by the General Accounting Office to be as much as 45%, it is a lavish perk provided courtesy of hardworking taxpayers. Because it is now a major cornerstone of the welfare state, politicians no longer even talk about eliminating it. It was completely untouched by the 1996 welfare reform. After the Republicans took over Congress in 1994, they attempted a very minor reform. They planned to deny the refund to childless workers, repealing a change that had just gone into effect. The largest change was a lower income ceiling at which the partial credit would kick in. Overall, the Republicans offered only a slight change in the rate of increase. Clinton went on the offensive to claim that Republicans were increasing taxes on the working poor. He used Washington's two classic lies to great effect. One, a reduction in the rate of increase is a cut. And two, there is no distinction between a tax credit and an outright subsidy. Republicans, who have used these lies for their own purposes, never developed an effective response to Clinton's absurdities. One clue to the true nature of the program is that the government wants people to use it. Quote, "The measure of our success," said IRS Commissioner Fred Goldberg in 1993, "is if every family entitled to this credit claims it and gets every dollar they are due." End quote. Have you ever heard of the government advertising a real deduction like the home office deduction, much less longing for people to use it? The only way to reform this program is first to expose it as welfare redistribution program that it really is. It should not be called the Earned Income Tax Credit. It should be denounced as the Unearned Income Transfer Payment and immediately abolished. So long as that solution is not contemplated, the program will grow without limit, drawing more and more people into the ranks of the government's dependents. Such is the price of intellectual compromise. All right, so that's the article. I told you Lawrence Vance is just a tremendous writer. So, but how does this play in? How is this an example of what I've been talking about? Well, by now I hope you're able to see just how disastrous the results can be when utilitarians attempt to implement policies based on predicted consequences. Milton Friedman himself, who is otherwise a fantastic thinker and a brilliant mind, believed that the Earned Income Tax Credit was desirable because it would guarantee a certain amount of harmony and prosperity and freedom for people who might otherwise be less fortunate. And he justified it by claiming that it would help get people off conventional welfare and live on earned income while creating no new bureaucracies. But see, this is precisely where Friedman made his critical mistake. He acted as utilitarian, or, as I've been calling them, minarchists. See, he was focused on the potential outcomes, which he thought would yield greater freedoms, but he failed to apply the primary principles. He failed to evaluate the morality behind the idea of taxation and forcible redistribution of property. You see, if it's not understood right from the very beginning that taxation is nothing more than the immoral taking of someone's property, then this mistake is quite easy to make. If the ends are argued to justify the means, then you'll fall into this trap every time. But the natural rights libertarians, or anarchists, would have understood this right from the beginning, and they would have avoided the whole kerfuffle. And folks, this is precisely why I do not take the jabs, which refer to anarchists as ideologues, as insults at all. Quite to the contrary, I take them as compliments. After all they're really saying is that I have a tendency towards logical consistency and a propensity for peace. Whoa, they really showed me. And before we finish up, keep in mind that those skyrocketing earned income tax credit payments that Vance wrote about, and he was referencing figures from 1996. I've just checked the current figures for 2017, and the earned income tax credit is now up to $6,269 for a family of three or more children. Just imagine what this supposedly libertarian program costs the taxpayers every single year. Yes, I am quite content being an idealistic anarchist. All right. Well, I'm going to link to that article that I just read called Friedman's Mistake. I'm going to link to that at the show notes page, battleforliberty.com/31. Before we're done for today, I just want to remind you that if you have any ideas for the show, topics you'd like me to discuss, please feel free to send them my way at mike@battleforliberty.com. Send me an email. I'll be happy to get back to you. And if you'd like, I'll make it into a show topic. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and refer that friend. If you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher, please take the extra 45 seconds it takes to submit a positive review. That'll help get the podcast to the top of the search results. As always, I want you to spread the word about the battle for liberty as far and wide as you can. And until next time, battle on.